For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here on the critically acclaimed network. Gosh darn it. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film, write stuff over there. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool. You needn't, but you may.
Take the opportunity, I say. And listen, we've got a lot of emails, so we're just going to jump right in. Here's how it works. You send us your emails, or possibly your snail mail. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, you can send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. Do it today.
Yes, and before we get going, yes, good. No, you, yes. No, you. I insist.
No, you. Just we're in a bit of a goofy mood, aren't we?
We are. I may be a little out of it. I did just find out today that I have I'm once again caught COVID. So
no!
I am isolating. We're doing this the old-fashioned way, separately, miles apart via the internet. That's the old-fashioned way, right? So if I'm a little congested, if I sound a little hoarse, that would be why, but otherwise I'm okay. We're good to record, and let's just dive right in. Let's not waste any time.
Okay. Fine. Here is an email from Kate. Hello, Kate.
Hello.
Kate says, "Hi, podcast hosts, whom I don't know personally." Well, we've corresponded now, so we have a degree of connection. I heard you're recording a mailbag episode, and I have a question. Recently, a friend told me she had seen Vertigo for the first time and didn't like it. Mm. Obviously, I gasped and shouted, "But zoom in and dolly back!" And that got me wondering, are there other films so closely associated with a particular camera shot or technique, or any other techniques you can trace through generations of filmmakers in the same way? Feel free to ignore this question if you don't like it. Well, we like it.
We like it just fine. First off...
Have a good night, Kate.
Thank you. Yes, we think you're fabulous. To answer your question, yeah, there are. First off, before we even get into that, I want to tell your friend, if they're listening, it is okay not to love Vertigo. That is one hell of a shock, but the movie is kind of wonky. I was recently on an episode of Screen Drafts where we were ranking the various Alfred Hitchcock movies, and I got in trouble for ranking it pretty low for a variety of like story and narrative reasons, which I don't think are functional, but God, is it pretty. It's good cinematography.
I've said this before about Vertigo. It's a film that is better the more you know about filmmaking in general, but Alfred Hitchcock in particular. Like it's commenting on everything that particular filmmaker is obsessed with, and it's also really kind of revolutionary for the way films were going at the time. It's like super duper stylized compared to a lot of other films from 1958, but that means there's some pretense involved. If you go to film school and you study film and you know Hitchcock really, really well, you might be a little bit more on Vertigo's wavelength. You can't sit down and in front of Vertigo with a Hitchcock noob and
you can't, it won't play the same way. It won't play the same way.
Yeah, like
To put it in modern terms, imagine watching The Fablemans as your first Steven Spielberg movie.
That wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah, it'll work as a movie, kind of. I'm actually not a fan, but like it'll function as a movie, but you're not going to pick up on all of the lore that Steven Spielberg is exploring in his own work. And I think that's true for Vertigo as well. But to answer the question, there are a lot of movies, not a lot, that's probably, because there can't be that many, but there are quite a few films that have pioneered a certain technique or popularized a certain technique or used a certain technique to such a powerful extent that they became either noteworthy or influential. One of the more famous ones, off the top of my head, is the original very long crane take in Touch of Evil.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The movie opens with someone setting a time bomb and putting it in someone's trunk, and then we follow them throughout an entire town until...
Without any edits. Yeah, no edits. Just sort of floats through the whole city, yeah.
Yeah, which they didn't invent, but was really novel, and then it explodes, like, all in one go. And that's something that has been repeated, copied, arguably done better. I Am Cuba has another, like, really legendary single long tracking shot that is also just incredibly riveting. Russian Ark is nothing but one long shot, for example. That's one of the first things that comes to mind.
The one that comes to mind for me, one that is like associated with a specific film, is probably it became so strongly associated with a movie that other filmmakers could no longer use it, and that was the bullet time stuff that the Wachowskis did in The Matrix.
Yeah, good point.
They did this really wonderful technique where they set up a whole series of cameras that were to shoot a single frame each, arranged around the actors. So it could film essentially a still image or a quick moving like fight sequence from several, like as if the camera were sweeping around at once, but it was like digitally blended. So it had this weird kind of ethereal disconnected quality, and it looked really, really cool.
Yeah.
The famous sequence was when the Carrie Ann Moss character like jumps and then freezes in midair, and while frozen, the camera angle changes, and that wasn't something that was seen in movies before. And that was so, so cool that people could only parody it.
Well,
because the Matrix was like the first to really kind of make that kind of look look really impressive and like really kind of public. And so that was it for bullet time. We couldn't do that anymore.
The other thing with bullet time is that it's a technique that takes you out of the movie. We're calling attention to the artifice of the movie because that's not something that can be replicated in real life. So it's actually very, very hard for filmmakers to come up with another use for it. For the record, it was not originated in The Matrix. I believe the first time it was done was in the movie Blade, believe it or not. There might have been a precursor before that, but Blade definitely did it before The Matrix. I remember they used to have these little preview shows in front of movies that played theatrically in Los Angeles, brought to you by the Los Angeles Times, and there were these little short films, usually about the making of movies, and it would show you like, oh, here's how miniatures work, and we're going to show you like how it works in like Temple of Doom. And in order to show off bullet time, they put like a bunch of people on like a Wild Wild West set and like threw someone out a window and it bullet timed around them, or a bunch of kids were like washing a dog in the barn and the dog went flappy flappy and water went everywhere, and the bullet time like made you see like all the water particles in the air, and it made you realize just how useless this technique really is. Because it really just doesn't fit. The one movie, and it's a bad movie, but there's one movie I actually think did bullet time very well. And it's right at the beginning of the movie Swordfish.
Where the shrapnel bomb goes off.
There's a huge bomb that goes off, and normally you just see a big explosion and you go, wow, what an explosion. But they use bullet time to really get the full extent of the chaos in a way that normally you would never register. And I thought that was really, really quite smart.
So there are smart ways to do it. I just think, you know, maybe filmmakers, A, associated it too strongly with The Matrix. I know Max Payne, it's not a movie I saw, but I know that Max Payne did something with bullet
time. Video
game, very impressive.
The video game employed bullet time so that you could, like, slow down otherwise fast-moving action in, like, a gunfight in the game mechanics. So they used
The film.
Well, the film did it too, but the film is faithfully adapting that one aspect of the video game.
Okay.
Here's one that I don't think gets enough credit anymore. Saving Private Ryan, Janusz Kaminski, it had been done before, but he popularized this technique where you change the degree on the shutter in the camera so that everything looks incredibly crisp. This is a little complicated, and I don't want to get it wrong, but suffice it to say, when a 35mm, 70mm, 16mm camera, if a physical film camera, is recording, there is a shutter that passes in front of the lens over and over again, sort of separating one frame from the next. And depending on how wide that shutter is, the average is 180 degrees, so it's like half of a circle. You're capturing a certain amount of action within the single frame. So 180 degrees is actually pretty wide. And that's why you'll see, like, motion blurring. Like, if you freeze frame on, like, something moving across your screen, you can see, like, it's not super crisp necessarily. Janusz Kaminski brought that way down to, like, 90 or 45 degrees, one of those. And that's why Saving Private Ryan, especially in the big action sequences, you can see, like, every individual particle of dirt, because the frame was only open for such a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second that there's no motion blur. And everything looks like it's just incredibly detailed and crisp to the point where it seems like your senses are heightened. And yeah, after he did that, after Janusz Kaminski did that, again, I don't think he invented it, but like after he did that, people copied that and they still do. Like Ridley Scott adopted that for Gladiator. Like it became very, very popular.
It became popular, but it never looked as good as in Saving Private Ryan. I don't think anybody could really replicate it well. And it just gave sort of a granular, really kind of ugly sheen to a lot of movies. I know a lot of cinematographers started imitating that. One that really rubbed me the wrong way was Training Day, which came out a few years later. Mm. And it tried to like add a lot of like grit and realism, and it just looked like a shoddy movie. It looked like it was just badly filmed. I'm trying to think of like other techniques. There are some techniques that are associated with a movie that... that failed, like the techniques didn't work out and nobody imitated them. Like the high frame rate stuff that Peter Jackson and Ang Lee were trying to do for a second. There's nothing really notable about Gemini Man, for instance, other than the fact that it was filmed in this super duper high frame rate and was supposed to be projected that way. Same with the first of the Hobbit movies that Peter Jackson did. They thought that this was going to be the future of film. And here's the problem. Film projectors have actually gotten so advanced that they struggle to project a film at 24 frames a second if they're transferring something from like a 35mm film stock. So they're such a massively complicated machines that they can't flicker quite that slowly. They need to move more quickly than that. So there's a lot of companies that are trying to create a new kind of like... It's like a really advanced kind of motion smoothing. Mm. It's like on your TV, but like far, far more advanced that actually is trying to make the frame rate increase. And I feel like the only film that shot in a high frame rate that worked, that looked good all the way through, was that second Avatar movie.
Well, they didn't use it all the way through. They used it in key sequences.
Sorry, good. And it was also, you know, the special effects are super advanced in that movie, and, you know, James Cameron is taking, you know, 13 years to make it, so he's really paying attention to all of these technical details, and all of these, you know, super advanced, you know, projectors are being installed, and it's also in 3D.
Yeah.
He took the time and he spent the money to make sure it actually looked okay, and as such, it's one of the only films that was able to shoot in a high frame rate. And the special effects just looked convincing as a result, rather than it just looking kind of fakey and low budget.
I still maintain that there are elements of that film cinematography that show off, you know, sort of limitations of that, or that we haven't really nailed it. Every time the speed ramps from 24 to a higher frame rate, it looks like the characters suddenly like jump forward, and that's always very jarring. I also worry. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. COVID. I also worry that when you have a movie where everything is crisp like that, like every single part of it is crisp and bright and colorful, it is harder for a filmmaker to draw the eye to where the story wants it to go. And I maintain there are certain shots in Avatar The Way of Water, especially in a theater, where you're really enveloped by it, where it's a little harder to actually follow the characters because everything looks equally impressive. And on that note, speaking of another technique, deep focus in Citizen Kane was another example of that, where the background and the foreground were equally in focus. And Greg Toland had also invented the split diopter shot. I think he invented that. I think it was for... Was it for The Long Journey Home, or... Okay, well, anyway, the split diopter shot was like a lens where half of it was in one focal length and half of it was in another, so that you can sort of bring different elements closer together. You can always kind of see the line. Brian De Palma played with this a lot, but that's been there. But Citizen Kane had a lot of novel camera techniques. But what about, and we should move on soon, but what about like specific shots, like Persona, like when you go to see a movie and it's one shot, and it's not just the content of the shot. It's not like, you know, Bill Murray whispering to Scarlett Johansson. Like, no, the actual artistry of the shot itself is like, you got to see it, man. So, like, the scene where the two faces merge in Persona. I mean, that's a famous one, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the most famous shots in all cinema. Yeah. To the point where, yeah, that's another thing that's so strongly associated with the movie Persona, though, and with Ingmar Bergman, that it shows up on, like, Animaniacs spoofs. Like, other filmmakers can't really do that in the same way without reminding them of Persona.
Yeah. Well, anyway, great question.
All right, let's go to another letter.
You're neat.
This is a letter from Starship. Hello,
ooh,
Starship.
Hello, Starship.
It says, "Greetings, sirs. I wanted to talk about Star Trek." Of course.
Oh, yeah.
We have a Star Trek podcast, and we just tried to, like, ramp up our output on it because we're now in the period in Star Trek history where we're covering two shows simultaneously.
Yeah, they were both
Next
on
Generation,
the same
Deep
week.
Space Nine. Yeah. We're on at the same time, you know, two episodes per week. So we're trying to keep up with that. We'll see if we can.
The goal is to hopefully catch up to Star Trek before we die. I don't think we will, but I think this is the only way we might be able to pull it off.
You know what? I think it's going to go smoother than we think. Until we get to that two-part Hirogen episode of Voyager, and we're just going to want to stall out. It's like, what the f***
are we
doing?
What have we done? What have we wasted our lives?
Anyway, I wanted to talk about Star Trek. I enjoy your reviews very much, but there are a couple of things I want to defend, so buckle up.
Oh, God. Okay, here we go.
First off is Spock and Uhura's romantic relationship in the Kelvin movies. I'm a white person, and I don't want to put words in people's mouths, but I've heard many women of color who love Trek over the years and praise the addition of that relationship because it's something that doesn't happen often. A black female is not treated as desirable or relationship material in a big sci-fi franchise. Certainly, she doesn't end up with the lead or co-lead, I guess. Seeing her portrayed as such has meant a lot to a lot of people. I just think that it's a perspective worth noting when talking about the relationship.
That's a fair point.
This is fair.
No, that's 100% fair. I do think that they don't necessarily do a good enough job showing us what they mean to each other. It always feels a little perfunctory to me. But I agree that there has been issues in the past of a sexualizer, or in some cases even failing to sexualize people of color. In Star Trek, I mean, one of the most famous bits in all of Star Trek is everyone's like, oh, that famous kiss with Kirk and Uhura, that was so groundbreaking. Yeah, the context of the scene, they're being forced to do that or they'll die. It's actually gross.
Yeah, they're being, like, yeah, psychically forced by these, like, sadistic aliens.
It's not as progressive a moment as it seems in a vacuum. So I agree that giving that Uhura really, more agency in a romantic subplot is a good idea.
Yeah, the kiss gets a lot of flack because some people have said that it was banned on television in certain states in the United States, and the assumption is that it was banned because it was a black woman kissing a white man, and it turns out if you've seen that episode, it was banned because it's really freaking disturbing.
It's
actually about
the episode of TV.
It is about, like, torture and sadism. It's not the kiss that people were upset about. It's the rest of the content of the episode.
There's a scene in that episode, and it's really hard to convey just by describing it, but I need to assure you that this genuinely freaked me out. These godlike...
So is this a horse scene?
Yeah. There's these godlike beings, and they can control people with their minds, take away their free will, make them do whatever they want, no matter how degrading it is. And they make Captain Kirk, against his will, become, not physically transform, but just act and move and think he is a horse. And you can see Shatner, like, you know, just like get down on his hands and knees, this look of horror in his face at being forced to do something he doesn't want to do. And it's genuinely disturbing.
Yeah, it's like, it's a really nightmarish episode. It's one of the scarier ones.
True. All right, but we have more points. We have more points, so let's bring them up.
Anyway, and this says, and for you, Bibbs, addressing you personally here, I've got Bones to pick with you.
All right.
Dr. McCoy is my favorite Star Trek character.
All right.
And I need to at least defend his relationship with Spock. I've heard you both say that they just hated each other, but I think that's reductive. Do you really think there's nothing but hatred between them? Nothing positive? Well, I've come with receipts. McCoy does pick on Spock quite a bit, that's true, but he also defends him to other people, including Kirk, in The Menagerie, in The Conscience of the King, in The Omega Glory and Obsession, and in Plato's Stepchildren.
You did do
and
your
in The
research.
Final Frontier.
Wow.
Yeah.
Touché.
It reminds me of a sibling thing. I can pick on him, but nobody else can. That sort of thing. McCoy was willing to die for Spock in The Empath, and he chose to risk himself again on that chance, on the chance that Spock could be fully restored in The Search for Spock. They gave him the choice, and he chose the danger. In that same movie, McCoy tells Spock that he couldn't stand to lose him again. Did you miss that line? Ooh. And Spock trusted McCoy with his Katra in the first place. He didn't have to do that. McCoy was never angry about that when you could argue that it was a major violation. McCoy spent a great deal of time in Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home just keeping an eye on Spock and meeting him with patience and smiles. Even Kirk loses his temper with Spock in that movie, and McCoy doesn't. After holding his Katra, there's no venom in McCoy when he speaks to or of Spock ever again. Little things in your reviews jump out at me. For example, you said in your Plato's Stepchildren episode that McCoy yells at Spock for not being angry enough. That's not what happens at all. Oh. McCoy and Kirk are being very gentle with Spock. They're talking about what happened, yes, and McCoy suggests that releasing his anger would be healthy, but there's no shouting or even arguing, really. They are discussing, that's all. Watch the scene again. Jim, who has initially brought them together because they're both endlessly devoted to him, and he loves and needs both of them. But over the course of the series and the movies, their relationship can stand on its own. If there was ever real hate between them, it was gone before the end of the series. Sorry this wound up being so long, but Spock and McCoy's relationship is my favorite in all of Trek. It's so fascinating to me that I think there's more to it than you give it credit for. Still love all of your work. All the best. Starship.
Starship, thank you so much. And I think... I'll fight you on one of the... There's one element in your supporting arguments that I'll take issue with, and it's a little thing. But you said that Spock trusted Bones to take his Katra, take his soul within him, his mind. And he didn't have to do that. I would argue he did. He was the only one there. I think if Kirk was there, he might have done it to Kirk instead. We will never know.
Yeah.
But I do believe that that's there's more circumstance maybe informing that than love. I will say this. I think that the further we get from the original series as we're reviewing Star Trek episodes, and we're doing them in order and we're like 250 episodes in, the further away we get from the original series, the less vivid they may be in our memory, and I think that's fair to say. I do think what we're talking about, and at least I can say from my own perspective, Whitney, I'll let you give your thoughts. I don't necessarily... I think when we say that McCoy hates Spock... I'm being a bit jesty, I think I'm being a bit jokey, but I do believe, and I think that Roddenberry is commenting on this, I don't necessarily like the way he did it, I do believe that although Spock and Bones do have some care for each other and would consider each other friends, there is an underlying undercurrent of racism that they are both dealing with to one degree or another. Spock's condescension towards humanity really pisses off Bones in a way it doesn't Kirk, and Bones's portrayal of take on Spock as inferior because he doesn't have human emotions. What's wrong with you is something that comes up a lot, and this is the sort of thing that we were seeing like a lot of in the 1960s in film and television as the civil rights movement started to become something that filmmakers and TV makers had to address. And they started falling really quickly into the defiant ones over and over again. What if people are kind of shoved together normally wouldn't be? I think there's some good that comes of that, some bad that comes of that. But maybe to give it a certain, this is after the original series, but if you look at the movie In the Heat of the Night, Rod Steiger is a racist cop who works with Sidney Poitier, who is a black cop, city cop. And eventually they form a regard for each other, but there's always this undercurrent of we don't necessarily like each other or what the other person represents. We haven't necessarily overcome, yeah, at least initially, our prejudices, or especially Rod Steiger's, because, I mean, Sidney Poitier's, he's got a lot more valid points, but... regardless, that's how I kind of look at Bones and Spock. It's like basically like this is where the conversation of racism is in Star Trek on a regular basis. And I think Bones is often the front of that because he's the one saying the most condescending stuff most of the time. But do I think it's all hate? No, no, that's fair.
Yeah. So something that I've and this might say more about me than about Star Trek, but I've always liked the episodes of Star Trek where the characters are depicted as like really good coworkers.
Yeah.
They're work friends. They know each other really well. They work together all the time. But when it's time for them to clock out, they're not going to hang out. They have their own families and their own hobbies to pursue. They're not that kind of buddy. And so when I see something like Star Trek V, where we see Kirk, Spock, and McCoy going camping together because they're on shore leave, it's like, Don't they have lives beyond each other? I don't like in Star Trek when I hate to say it. I don't like it when they're friends. I don't like it when and by that I mean I don't like it when these characters become each other's lives, and then you know, later on when they start, you know, making movies or when they start rebooting shows and these characters get really kind of weepy about, you know, the time they had together. Yeah, I get really sentimental about like meeting some old coworkers that I worked with like 20 years ago, but I wouldn't want to work with them again. You know, I don't want to go back to my old job. It's a job. You know, they have lives that move forward. So the idea that Spock and Bones found that they could work well together and they had a healthy regard for each other's integrity and intelligence is great. And I love that aspect of the relationship. Mm. But I don't buy that they're buddies. You know, I don't buy that they're friends. I don't think they really like each other that much.
I think you can find an interesting analog to this in the actual production of Star Trek itself, where here are actors who have worked together on and off for decades, and they certainly know each other extremely well. But if you actually pay attention to what they've said about each other, what they've written about each other, and their experiences making the show, they don't always like each other. In fact, a lot of them don't. And that's just part of it. We work together. This is part of the job. And I think what happens sometimes is that there is a conflation of the audience's affection, their sort of parasocial affection for the characters in their shows, that then bleeds into the show itself, as if all of the characters feel the same way about each other that the audience does. And I think there's some shows, some movies that get away with that better than others. I think one great example of this is it's weird. I don't know if it's bad. I think I was more critical of it earlier on, but I do think it's weird. In Fast and Furious 7, where tragically Brian, the guy, the actor who played Brian, oh god, why am I forgetting his name?
Paul Walker,
thank you. I have COVID. Cut me some slack. Paul Walker tragically passed away way too young and in the middle of that production, and they had to hastily figure out a way to finish the movie without him and also to explain what happened to him. And a lot of people were afraid he was just going to get killed off, which is kind of the obvious move. It's very mercenary, but it would have been. Instead, they decided to say that the character stayed alive but retired from the world of race car crime driving / spies, and that's fine, but they treat him retiring like he died, because the audience is saying goodbye to this character. The people who made the movie and clearly cared about this guy are doing that as well, but it no longer makes sense in the context of the story, because he's just hanging out with your sister, Vin. You can call him anytime in the narrative, but we have conflated the reality of these people with their characters that they play, and so the movie kind of feels right, even though if you look at it as purely as a movie, it doesn't really work anymore.
I'm willing to give that one some slack, just because that was the thing that was on the audience's mind.
Exactly.
And I think that the people who were following that series knew exactly what was happening behind the scenes. It was tasteful because I think that's the best way to handle the tragedy of the real world actor dying in the middle of this scene.
I'm not saying it's not tasteful. I think it's very tasteful. I agree with that. Yeah.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate how tasteful it is.
But yeah. Any other thoughts before we move on the Bones conundrum?
I think I like Bones. I do. I also like Bones. I like the character. I like kind of how crotchety he is, actually. He's like, he's the reminder of the things we need to rise above in the idealized future of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because he does still have a lot of prejudices, but he's also very talented. So we keep him around because he's a good doctor, and we keep him around because there's hope for him.
Yeah.
That he's going to be able to grow and change.
He, like Spock, who becomes more human, Bones becomes a bit more human, too. Really.
But yeah,
he's becoming more understanding and sympathetic.
But, you know, he has a tendency to sort of fall back in his old crotchety ways, and I think those crotchety things are actually very funny.
Yeah.
Like, when he shows up in Star Trek The Motion Picture in his, like, 70s disco outfit and his big beard, and he's, like, you know, raising his middle fingers, fuck you, I don't want to be here anymore. Like, that's funny. I like those moments. But I do feel like his relationship with Spock is one of more professional regard than actual friendly closeness. I don't think these are the kinds of people who would go on vacation together. That's all.
Fair enough. Anyway, moving on.
Next letter. This one comes from Emma. Hello, Emma. Greetings, William and Rockmeister. Oh, that's me.
Hi.
I have a task for you. Uh-oh. If you're up for it.
Okay, let's do it.
I know you like pitching ideas and spitballing concepts on the fly, so I'm now presenting you with one. I was looking over original stories that have been adapted in several forms in different media, i.e. Peter Pan being a play, several movies, TV series, etc.
Yeah.
And I tried to find one that hadn't got such versatile adaptation, but... had gotten such versatile adaptations, but never a film version. I managed to find a classic and very influential sci-fi novel, and this is where I would like your twisted yet brilliant mind to turn it into a movie.
Okay.
It's a book I know you're aware of and probably have read, which has been turned into a graphic novel series, two radio plays, a video game, a stage production, several music videos, and even mentioned in several song lyrics, and yet it has never been turned into a movie, despite the fact that the book is pretty short. So I'm giving you a blank check and a task. Turn Harlan Ellison's I Have No Mouth
Oh, God.
Scream into a movie.
We were literally just talking about this. Oh, my God. We were literally just talking about that short story. Okay. Is that the end of the letter?
To pause, I have...
Okay.
No, there's more, but I'm just going to describe it. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. It's actually a short story. It's only about 40 pages. It takes place in the distant future after we've given over all of our responsibilities to one gigantic supercomputer. And the supercomputer over the years grew more and more intelligent, and they all linked up together, and it became this one gigantic mass consciousness, and it called itself AM. A-M. And AM... was dealing with, like, the war machine and war efforts and shooting people and dropping bombs, and it came to look at humanity with complete and utter contempt. It started to hate humans to the point where Am, just out of spite, wiped out all of humanity except for five people. And it moved those five people underground and, using, like, miracle technology and surgery, is keeping them alive for centuries, torturing them incessantly just because he hates them so much.
It's partly because he hates them so much, or they, or whatever Am is. It's partly because they hate them so much, and also partly because that's all Am has, is their contempt. And Am is actually a very interesting character. It's not just this purely, you know, evil thing. So yeah, a lot of it takes place in, like, basically a virtual reality simulation of... existence that is permanently torturous or transformed against them in some way. It's a sort of thing that you could do with on any budget, but you would have obviously limitations. Like, you could do it on zero budget, it would be really abstract. You could do it on a gigantic budget, and you would have all of these, like, horrifying nightmare images and monsters and things.
Let me finish the letter before we start the pitching. It says, for a story as influential as I Have No Mouth is, I do find it strange that it has never been adapted to the big screen, especially since we are now living in the time of AI. and how frightening the idea of am is in the year 2025. You can simply do it briefly, but the perfect movie adaptation into my mind, who should direct it, who should star in it, who should voice am, and should it be live action or animated? Could it be R? Could you do it in PG-13? And would you update it to fit our modern understandings of AI? The novel has been stuck in my head since the first time I read it. Let's just say that I have turned all smart functions off of my phone and I'm staying far away from ChatGPT.
I think that's smart.
To me, this is a scarier depiction of the thinking machine than any sci-fi movie I have ever seen, and maybe the scariest book I have ever read. Can't wait to hear your answer. Live long and prosper. Emma.
Emma, great question. And again, I love that story. That story broke my mind the first time I read it.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's do this thing, though. We've already described the plot for people who may not be familiar with it. There's more to it than that, but that's the gist. Let's start with the obvious one, director. I think the obvious answer is David Cronenberg.
Cronenberg, okay.
I honestly think so, because I think it is, you know, he's fascinated by, you know, the depths of the human mind, but also its interconnectivity with the human body. And I can imagine him cutting back and forth between in an existence kind of way, this like false reality, but also really getting into the nitty gritty of what being forced to live for this long is doing to their bodies. And I think that could be some really horrifying reveals to it. That's kind of the obvious one. Like who besides Cronenberg, like who might be up for this?
I'm not sure. I guess Cronenberg would be a good choice just because, Cronenberg tends to deal with like personal pain. He hates the phrase, but he does body horror.
Yeah. He almost directed Total Recall. Of, like, don't forget.
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of the elements that we see in Paul Verhoeven's film were brought in by Cronenberg while he was in charge of it. He was directing it and like changing a lot of the story. And yeah, he ended up a lot of like I think the fact that there's this like underground of mutants on Mars was an idea that Cronenberg brought to the thing.
Memory that serves, that's correct. Over.
I'm trying to think of like who's a cynical enough filmmaker, because it's an incredibly bitter story. Well, it's not a hopeful story. It has nothing good to say about humanity. It's about how we are awful, we deserve this, and we lose.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of like who,
I think there's
who could
an element
direct.
Of that. I also think you have to look at someone who is capable of filming. Again, the abstract. Mm-hmm. My other thought, Panos Cosmatos of Mandy fame.
Oh, Panos Cosmatos would be good. Yeah. Could definitely handle like the visuals and the tone correctly. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of like, because I would love to. Oh, you know who could do it? He hasn't done a movie in a couple of years, but Shinya Tsukamoto, who did Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Oh, I mean, well, yeah.
He could, I think he could really do, but the thing is, I would want kind of a low budget version of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Sure, you could do sort of a big budget version where you could sort of create the realm that M has created and like treat it like this big shimmering VR simulation, but it's actually about how miserable these five main characters are and how, you know, the world changes around them, but they're constantly... they're not dazzled by it. It's not a dazzling world for them. It shouldn't look shimmering and impressive. It should look cold and spare and kind of confusing.
Yeah.
So keeping something low budget for something like this might help.
The guiding principle I might apply to that, if we're going with that perspective, is try to imagine this as an original Twilight Zone episode. You can be feature length, but it's this is the vibe. You can be a little bit more expensive than an original Twilight Zone episode, but that's what we're going for. We're going for the psychology of it. I do believe that you're going to want to pull out the stops once in a while, because otherwise we're not taking full advantage of the medium. Because as they pointed out, there have been like radio plays, and that works perfectly in that format. But if we're going to put it on film, I think of... that old saw that in horror, what you don't see is scarier than what you do. And then I think about John Carpenter's The Thing, in which he said, no, I'm going to come up with something so scary that you're going to look at it and go, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. And he pulled it off. So I do believe a couple of times, at least throughout the movie, there will have to be moments where you do have to really freak us out visually. And not in the most obvious ways. Oh, here's a monster. Oh, here's a shadowy room. No. Really, really push... and show us something we haven't seen before.
I've got it. I know who should direct the I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream movie. It should be Eddie Alcazar. Eddie Alcazar did a film last year that I really, really liked in 2023. I guess 2 years ago now. It was called Divinity. It was this low-budget thing with Stephen Dorff. It's shot in black and white. It was also took place in this weird science, like, heady sci-fi space. But there's also, like, a stop-motion monster fight at the end of it. And it's, like, really, you know, about aliens and the power of sex work and the obsession with altering your body through steroids and, like, toxic masculinity. It's a fascinating, fascinating film. And it looks great. Shot in this kind of low-budget chiaroscuro black and white that is just, you know, dazzling in a cult movie kind of a way. I feel like that guy has the know-how and the attitude to handle something like Harlan Ellison. It's telling that his second movie, Eddie Alcazar's second movie, which he made in 2015, is called Fuck You! with three K's and three U's, all in capital letters. So, yeah, this guy, I think, knows how to handle that.
Okay, I haven't seen those movies, so I'm gonna say I've got my pitch as Panos. You've got yours. We'll see who has the better pitch. Now, for the voice of Am, I think I've got this, but it's I'm curious if you have another thought. Werner Herzog. You do not want Werner Herzog disappointed in you. You know? Like, Werner Herzog, he's got this, he knows more than you, and he's got a sense of humor, but he also, like, hates chickens. Like, you ever hear him talk about, like, chickens? Like, he just hates, he's capable of hate, and it's disturbing that someone so sensitive, so full of life and wonder and empathy, is also capable of hate. And I think that could be really scary. You remember him in that first Jack Reacher movie? He was freaky in that film.
Yeah, he was really good. Let's see here. Let me tell you how much I've come to hate you since I began to live. There are 387.44 million miles of printed circuits and wafer-thin layers that fill my complex. If the word hate was engraved on each nano-angstrom of these hundreds of millions of miles, it would not equal 1/1 billionth of the hate I feel for humans at this micro-instant for you.
Yeah. That, Herzog could say that.
That's great.
Herzog could say that. If you've ever... there's this really great bit. It's from a podcast, but it's on YouTube. You can find it. There's this really amazing bit where someone does this pretty spot-on Werner Herzog impersonation, and he comes up with a review, like a Yelp review that Werner Herzog wrote for the Trader Joe's on Hyperion in Los Feliz, California. And I now live close enough to that Trader Joe's that I'm intimately familiar with it, and everything he says is correct. It is a fucking Lovecraftian nightmare world where none of the geometry makes sense, and it's just fucking perfect. You should listen to that. But, like, yeah, no, I think Herzog is the one to go. But, again, if anyone else has, I'm open to be wowed. I would love to be, like, remember when, like, Heath Ledger was cast as the Joker and everyone's like, oh, I don't know, can he do that? And then he killed it.
Mm. Yeah.
There might be someone out there who we never thought was capable of great Am performance. And we just need to be open-minded, you know? Miley Cyrus killed it. She's amazing. Who would have thought?
No, I'm going to go way out on a limb here.
Okay.
Because there is an actor that I really admire when he can tap into his anger and his hate, but he's not known for it. Adam Sandler is fantastic when he's unleashing his anger. Yeah. Like, he would really be able to dig into that in a really interesting way, I think.
It's really, you're going to write a thin line, though, because if he ever accidentally tips into his comedy persona, or even just sounds like it, it's going to ruin the whole thing. You have to really, really, really dance on a knife edge to make that work. Yeah. But that is fascinating, though, and I can kind of see
the,
that.
The hate I have for you! Like, I could hear him. That'd be great. It'd be great.
Okay, I love it. So anyway, that's what we're doing. All right, we've got a couple of different pitches.
Also,
so we're gonna, what's up? Miss something?
That story was adapted into a video game in 1995, where you play as the characters that Am is torturing, and he sends them through these kind of like virtual reality versions of their previous lives. It's far different from the actual story, but that video game is going to be released on the Nintendo Switch this week.
Oh shit.
They're bringing it back. Yeah.
Like, that's what we were talking about. Really, I was trying to remember why it came up, because you were just talking about this. And that's why. Yeah.
It's like, because I knew the game was coming. I was really looking, because I never got to play the game much, and I wanted to go back and play it some more.
One other little bit of trivia. This is not important, but I do want to prove that, like, I do really love the story. when I was in film school at UCLA, we had to do a cinematography project, and we had to do, basically, you're going to take the 16mm camera, and you have, like, a day to shoot stuff, and you have to tell a complete story, no sound, pure visuals.
Okay.
I did a silent musical called I Have No Voice Yet I Must Sing.
Okay.
And had nothing else to do with it, but I did, a couple of people got the title, and I thought to myself, that's all I really care about, is that they get the title. I don't really care. They actually turned out fine, except for the fact that the camera fell off the tripod and broke, and
oh no!
It cost so much, but without actually going over like the deductible, that I no longer had money to like go into like the production track.
Oh no!
Because UCLA, you get the, unlike a lot of other schools where you make, they pay for your movies, but they own the rights to your movies. UCLA, you pay yourself, but your movies are all yours. At least that's the way it was when I was in school. So I'd like saved up some money so I can try to like make a short film for like my senior year. And then it was like, oh no, no, now I can't afford to do that. And I'm a cautionary tale. I'm pretty sure they still tell stories about the guy who accidentally broke the 16mm camera whenever they like give those out for a class assignment. Like, don't be William. Don't be William Bibbiani. Actually, that's good advice in general. You know what, Don't be Bibbs.
No, be Bibbs. He's a smart, insightful, kind human being. You should look up to him because he's great at many things.
Be me in a week when I don't have COVID. Okay, how about that?
Yeah, there you go. But wait until he's better. Then be really.
That's not going nuts. Anyway, we should move on. But that's a great prompt, though. I love that one. Thank you.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Here is a letter from Doruk. Hello, Doruk.
Hello.
Hello, Bibbs and Rocky McCool Man.
Love it.
I guess I'm Rocky McCool Man.
Yes, you are.
Hope you're doing well and healthy and as happy as much as you can be currently. Well, you know, William needs, will get better soon. My question is simple. What separates fiction from fan fiction? Besides outside factors like budget, studio backing, writer's acclaim, etc., recently we were arguing about Rings of Power with a couple of my friends, and they've claimed that the series feels like fan fiction of Lord of the Rings, to which I answered that the Lord of the Rings is fan fiction of Norse mythology to some extent. This got me thinking, what really separates fan fiction from art? Is there really that much of a difference between a fan script and a rewrite done by a newly hired screenwriter? I've been advocating for writers to demolish established canon, EU, to give us interesting and important stories if need be. Why not reboot Back to the Future for the 2020s, I say? One argument I've heard is that the story, if the story diverges that much from an existing intellectual property or story, it should have been a new story and not depend on the recognizability of the original, to which Joker is an apt example. I think for the most part, people write fanfic because they love the core of what the story is. One might even say that sometimes fans know, or at least claim to know, the central themes better than the studios, proven by countless script rewrites you can find on YouTube. I don't think what George Lucas did to Star Wars with the prequels, for example, is too different from what a guy in his bedroom wrote in 1990 for his tabletop Star Wars game, is it? I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on the topic. Also, if you do enjoy some fanfic in your spare times, any recommendations? Quick bonus question. What is your favorite Pokemon?
Oh, God.
I'd pick William as a Goodra guy and Whitney as a Mimikyu fan.
Oh, God.
take care, guys. All the love from Turkey, Doruk.
Oh, Thank you from Turkey.
Thank you.
Second question first.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Pokemon?
Meowth. Meowth is my favorite Pokemon.
I mean, he's the guy that talks, right?
I'm also
a Meowth guy. If you had to have a second Pokemon, though, who's your other? Who's your other one?
Oh gosh, what did I like? It's been a while since I kind of fell out of Pokemon. I was embarrassingly into it around the year 2000, and I was already in my 20s at that point.
See, I've never really been into it. I've never played all of the Pokemon game. I never even played most of one, and I never got too connected to it. I remember being really into Meowth because he got to be kind of his own character. But beyond that, I don't have a deep connection, so I'm going to recall for an episode of My Brother and Me, where they were talking about the perfect Pokemon, and I'm going to go with Big Dog Woof Woof McElroy's suggestion of Eevee, because is it a fox or a dog? It's super cute either way. You're happy no matter what.
I was fond of one back in the day. It was called Farfetch'd. I just like the name. Farfetch'd. It's just little bird. It carried around a leek, like a green onion. And it thwacked people with the leek, and I thought that was very amusing.
I do like a good leek.
And if you start looking into like Pokemon lore and descriptions and Pokedex stuff, they explain that the reason Farfetch'd carries the leek is because if you were to kill and eat one, it would taste good with a leek. So it's like
that's very thoughtful.
Walking around with its own, it's walking around with its own recipe. It's
really
like I would walk around just coated in meat tenderizer. That'd be great.
Is that why Doctor Who used to have like a sprig of like what did he have? He had celery on his lapel back in the early 80s.
Celery, so that's why
he just tasted good with celery. Do you think?
If you were to eat a Time Lord, he would taste great with celery. Anyway, as to the first question, what was the first question?
What's the difference between fiction and fan fiction? I'm gonna say I think that is not the best mentality to go into this to suggest that they're different. I think fan fiction falls under the umbrella of fiction. It is a particular type of fiction.
Yeah, I think. Well, what separates fan fiction from something that's not fan fiction? And I suppose the answer to that is, sadly, just a matter of legality. It's not anything to do with the artistry of it. It's just to do with who owns, like, the legal rights to something. If a studio, like, there's been a lot of debate, for instance, over which James Bond movies count as, like, the, quote, official ones. Like, Never Say Never Again, for instance, doesn't count.
Yeah.
The original Casino Royale doesn't count. They're still based on the same books. They start the same characters. Why don't they count? The James Bond films aren't in the same continuity with each other. Each one seems to be just sort of a general adventure of this character without much reference to what came before or coming after.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there are like little arcs, but they separate pretty frequently. You know, James Bond is this actor. Now he's this actor. Yeah. And we're just not going to address that. So what really a lot of what the sticklers are going to point to is which ones are owned by Eon Productions,
right,
which owns the rights part and parcel to the James. Well, they until recently owned the rights part and parcel to the James Bond series.
Yeah.
So that's what counts as canonical, and anything else that somebody who does not own the rights to that character and is doing something in their spare time, probably for free, that counts as fan fiction.
Well, we're really saying, I think what you're really saying, the word you're looking for, is unofficial.
Yeah.
That's what that is. I think that's what that, and again, I would argue that artistically, I give very few fucks about that. Now, it has some connection, because it's what you're allowed to use without getting into trouble, and there's some limitations to that, but a lot of the fan fiction you find online is like, hey, what if this happened in Supernatural? And we're not making any money off of it, so who cares? I think fan fiction, I've never really gotten super into it. I know a lot of people personally who have and speak very warmly and very, very praisingly of a lot of fan fiction. They say it's brilliant. I believe it. I've never. There's just so much that I honestly don't even know where to begin. And I've never really had a guide. So there's that. But
I think a lot of people tend to kind of dismiss fan fiction as a writing genre, as a form, merely because they're not based on original concepts. The author of fan fiction is taking characters, scenarios, performances, all of these aspects that have already been established by other artists, and kind of bringing their own take to it. Now, Doruk said in his letter that what's the difference between that and a writer who's hired to write a new story for an extant series? Like, think of a Star Trek writer. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference between somebody who's doing it for free in their college dorm and somebody who's doing it for money on the Paramount lot?
Just think about everyone who's hired to write a Spider-Man comic, but in a slightly different reality. What that's kind of very similar.
A comic books are a great example because comic books don't always connect. There's always one-offs, or what if Spider-Man was in this city, or let's ignore these events, or if Spider-Man were real, he would have such an eventful life. He would have died 18 times over, not just because of the fighting, just his brain would be too full. Nobody can live a life that significant. It's because there's teams and teams of writers and artists who are constantly creating new stories with this character. The difference is, and it really is, just a legal one. Who's getting paid money for it and who isn't? The writer of fan fiction is not hired by the studio. They're not getting a W-2, and as such, that counts as sort of fan fiction.
Here's my question with that for you, though. Because if it's purely a legal label or stigma or whatever you want to call it, excuse me, COVID. Is fan fiction, in your estimation, not a subgenre? Because a subgenre has to be quantifiable, and I would argue that simply having or not having legality to it, on paper, there's no other genre that's defined that way. So, is there an aesthetic that we associate, whether or not it's universal, because that's true for any genre, is there an aesthetic, a certain series of qualities that we associate with fan fiction to the extent that we can recognize either fan fiction or something that is evoking fan fiction on site?
I will say no. Fan fiction is defined by its authorship, not by its storytelling details. Because fan fiction can be fan fiction of anything. I could write Star Trek fan fiction, but I could also write Patrick O'Brien fan fiction. Right. I could write Gilgamesh fan fiction. There's no saying what I could do.
Let me ask you this. Is there perhaps an off-brand quality? Like the difference between eating Raisin Bran and, Ralph's Raisin Flakes. And you just know that this is slightly different. But just tweaked.
There is... I think you're going to know it because when you... And this, I'm speaking as somebody who has had a lot of nerdy conversations about, our particular fandoms, where we're just talking about Star Trek, for God's sake. I feel like the makers of something have strictures. They need to return to some kind of status quo, especially with something that's really long-running, like a long-running film series or a long-running TV show. As such... there's going to be a series Bible they're abiding by, right?
Okay.
The creator said you can only do these things and you can't do these things. A writer of fan fiction either is going to ignore that Bible or hasn't even seen it. Mm. So they're going to play a lot more faster, a lot faster and a lot looser with these actually written but unseen rules of the TV show or comic book series, whatever you're writing, in question.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. Yeah. Maybe that's what I'm getting at, is that whether we're consciously aware of it or whether we just know the material so well that we're subconsciously aware that there are certain guidelines, certain rules, certain things that can and cannot happen, either in terms of content or character or even just style, that when we see even those characters in a format, in a medium, in a story that breaks any of those fundamental rules. You can always play, but there's always a line where all of a sudden it is or is not Star Wars, for example.
Yeah.
Once we see that broken, whether we're conscious or unconscious of it, then it starts to arguably feel like fan fiction, which is why one could argue that something like The Rings of Power has a fan fiction-y feel to it.
Yeah, because it's breaking the rules, isn't it?
It's got parts of what we recognize from the previous live-action visual adaptations of The Lord of the Rings, but it isn't that. And as a result, it's very easy for some people to reject it and label it fan fiction, even though technically it's not, from a legal perspective.
Yeah, I would say, and it's two-edged sword. Like, to use a Star Wars example, George Lucas made Star Wars in 1977. He set kind of a certain kind of tone and a certain type of character that would be kind of followed in perpetuity as the series has ground on for decades. George Lucas kind of made his own version of fan fiction by making a whole three-part series of films only about Darth Vader and how Darth Vader grew up and became evil.
Mm.
And that feels like, that kind of focus feels like fan fiction to me. Like, we're really, as a fan, focusing on the experience of this one character who, in the first movie, wasn't as important as all that. At least not yet.
Mm. Well, this brings us back to that Star Trek question we had. Why do they feel so chummy at the end? And that's arguably because the fans feel that affection for them. So we're telling the story about Darth Vader because the audience is that interested in Darth Vader, not necessarily because it's the best story to tell.
Yeah,
at least not over three
films. And I feel like Rian Johnson kind of brought his own spin on Star Wars when he made The Last Jedi in, like, 2018 when that movie came out?
Yeah.
2017? I like that movie a lot, and I think it's because he kind of Star Trek'd Star Wars a little bit.
Okay.
Because he started to address things that had never been talked about in Star Wars before. It felt like he was breaking some rules. He talked about who is funding the Star Wars. Like, where does the money come from? He was talking about starship fuel, which was never a concern in any of the other Star Trek or Star Wars stories.
Yeah.
He was talking about, like, the chain of command and just following orders, which is a much more of a Star Trek thing.
Are the Jedi really as good as we've been led to believe? You know,
maybe they're just human and they make a lot of mistakes. Like, I like all of those wrinkles, but I think a lot of people objected because that felt like it was coloring outside of the lines for what had been established in older Star Wars movies.
Hmm.
So, but the difference is that one was given the studio money. It was legally owned by the owners of Star Wars. So that doesn't count as fan fiction. Although I think if somebody made that exact same film, on a budget, of course, just the same script, the same kind of story, the same kinds of characters, probably would have been pretty good fan fiction.
Mm.
I think people are going to be a lot more forgiving of fan fiction because we are giving them a little bit more leeway to play fast and loose with these strict rules, whereas the actual official product, we're going to be a little bit more, we're going to scrutinize a little bit more closely because it has those strictures and we know.
Yeah. I think we should move on, but I'm fascinated by this topic. I'm a huge fan of genre studies, in particular the sort of quantification of audience expectation, which I think is when genre really falls down to. You go into a genre with certain things that you expect, and you don't need to get all of them, but you want some, because that's why you pay to see romantic comedy or a disaster movie or whatever. But the problem is that my own lack of familiarity with the nuts and bolts, the nitty-gritty, the details, and the extensive history of fan fiction make me ill-suited to speak on this with that level of detail. So if anyone wants to write in and you have your own take on this and you want to describe what makes fan fiction, is fan fiction just a legality? Is that all there is to it? Or is there a particular aesthetic, whether or not it's universal, a quantifiably observable state in which a story can be told that either is fan fiction literally or feels like it? If you know more than I do about the topic, I'd love to hear it. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
I've never really delved into just the extant world of fan fiction, because I know there's whole communities out there. I know people love it because there's communities out there. They have other authors they can connect to. I think fan fiction is a good way for a lot of authors to find their own voice.
Right.
They start out writing stories for other characters and then realize, wait a minute, I know how storytelling works now.
Well, that's how
I tell my own stories.
You copy or you mimic or you try to evoke which you like about the arc you've already enjoyed, and then you find your own voice over time.
Yeah, the literary critic Harold Bloom talked about the anxiety of influence, how every piece of art is going to be a reaction to something that came before it, and how much are you repeating or criticizing something, and how much are you bringing originally to the table, and how aware of that is an author. And I think that's a really interesting conversation, especially in regards to modern fan fiction.
Right. All right, we should try to make time for a couple more because we haven't done an episode in a while. So why don't we do one or two more emails?
Okay, yeah, sounds good. Here is a letter from J-Lo. No, not that one.
Okay.
It's gents. Here in Pennsylvania, we're about 2 months away from outdoor movie season.
Ooh.
In addition to the region's drive-in theaters reopening, I'm preparing for another season of hosting outdoor movie nights for my friends. Last year, the most successful events were my birthday double feature of The Beekeeper and Dead Heat.
Nice. Wow, that's one hell of a double feature. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Beekeeper and Dead Heat.
Oh, but hair on your chest.
Summer camp movie night. There's the summer camp movie night with Wet Hot American Summer, Sleepaway Camp 2, and Ernest Scared Stupid.
Sleepaway Camp.
Oh, not Ernest Goes to Camp?
You went with Sleepaway Camp 2? Wow, you guys are hardcore.
Sleepaway Camp 2 is
I'm not saying it's not amusing, it's just, it's a choice. I think most people would gravitate towards the original. I think that's a very bold choice. I'm impressed. So, moving on.
Let's see, Sleepaway Camp 2... And October Scary Movie Night, Ernest Scared Stupid, House of Frankenstein, and the 1977 version of House.
Nice. Very nice.
Planning my first event for the month of April, the only logical day to host is a Saturday, April 19th, which is the night before Catholic and Orthodox Easter, the day before 420, and perhaps most importantly, the first night of WrestleMania 41.
Oh my god, that is a confluence of events.
Yeah. With this historical confluence of events, I'm picturing Stoner Jesus Movie Night and advertising it as a movie about Jesus and a stoner comedy, but I'm not sure what to settle on. Do you think I could get away with showing a double feature, Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, with Ohazard Balazar?
I mean, shit, now you have to. I would never have thought of that, and I want to see that, and if that was a double feature that was playing... in my town, I would move my schedule around. If they were like, hey, listen, there's a new Star Wars opening in like a year, and you get to see it early, but it's only showing on the 19th, I would be like, I am busy. They're showing Harold and Kumar and Ohazard Baltazar? Holy shit.
I think you could pair anything with Ohazard Baltazar because you'll be watching one of the greatest movies ever made regardless.
Tell people what Ohazard Baltazar is because I don't think everyone knows.
Okay, it's one of those... it's like the backbone of the Criterion Channel. You know, there's a couple of just sort of peerless classics that are always grouped together, and Ohazard Baltazar from 1966 is one of the peak. It's by Robert Bresson, who is one of the great filmmakers. Who wrote this kind of a picaresque tragedy about a donkey. It's kind of like a very loose adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Idiot, but the idiot is a donkey. And the donkey kind of moves from owner to owner and just suffers all, like, witnesses their pain and their personal problems and suffers at their hands, and, like, is beaten and takes a lot of abuse. And a lot of critics have taken it to also be a metaphor for Christ, like witnessing all of the evils of the world and kind of taking it on. And Robert Bresson also did Diary of a Country Priest, so has kind of that Catholic passage of pain and sin from one being to another as a common theme in some of his movies. And it's great, and it's sad, and it's really... dour and ascetic and beautiful in ways that are difficult to describe. It's one of the best movies of all time, just without exaggeration. It just is.
And it would be a great double feature with Shrek as well.
I'm not sure about Shrek.
It's a donkey movie. It wasn't going further than that.
Oh, it's the donkey.
That was it. That was the whole joke.
Does Shrek suffer? No. Okay.
No. Well, Okay, can you please write an essay for Slash Film called Does Shrek Suffer? And try to find a way to connect it to Ohazard Baltazar? Can you please pitch that? You don't have to do it, but could you pitch it at least? Because I want to read that.
Anyway, the letter continues. Joking aside, I'm likely screening either Monty Python's Life of Brian, Jesus Christ Superstar, or The Book of Clarence, which I have not seen yet, for the Jesus half, and I'm actually more at a loss for a stoner pairing. Any suggestions for a B feature to follow with a stoner theme? We've previously tried Up in Smoke, but couldn't really vibe with it. Is this really finally the time to watch Reefer Madness? I'd love some suggestions. Keep on keeping on, J-Lo.
Okay, so the books, so the films that they were thinking of was Life of Brian, Book of Clarence, and Jesus Christ Superstar. That's our starting point.
Yeah, okay. I guess if you're going with those movies, because those are kind of like, I don't want to say light, but like it's kind of comedic and or absurd in across the board.
Yeah.
So you're going to want something that can pair well with a stoner movie. I guess the question is how much whiplash do you want to give your audience when you're planning a double feature?
Yeah.
Because I'm very fond of whiplash. Same. When it comes to a double feature. I like a really stern movie followed by something really absurd.
Like, for example, if you're trying to commit to a tone, for example, let's say you didn't go with Jesus Christ Superstar, you thought about Reefer Madness, I would show the Reefer Madness musical, the one with Kristen Bell. That would go together very, very well. They're both very campy musicals in a lot of ways. They're both dealing with very serious topics in a somewhat broad fashion. I think they go very, very well together, but they might go too well together. Whitney's point is well taken. So, I'm trying to think now.
Let's see. You know what? One of my favorite stoner movies, and keep in mind, just to get a little personal for a minute, I never touched weed as a youth. I just wasn't interested. I didn't drink either. I was a complete teetotaler all throughout my 20s, and right. I didn't really start tasting alcohol until I was in like my early 30s. And I have since been high a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Never did it on the regular. A few times. Mm-hmm. I know what it's like. I haven't been in that spot where I know the experience well enough that I want to pair it with a feature film. Mm. I don't know what that's like. I don't know what it's like to watch a movie. All I know is, like, when I'm high, I can't concentrate on anything, so a movie wouldn't make any difference to me.
See, that's the thing about stoner movies. There's two kinds of stoner movies. There's stoner movies that are about stoners, you know, like Up in Smoke, or about the Big Lebowski. And then there are movies that are great to watch while stoned, which aren't necessarily about stoners. In fact, they're often not.
No, and yeah, usually they're like really like heady. Like I know people talk about Alejandro Jodorowsky movies. Those are good to watch while stoned. I wouldn't know.
Or something very, very silly would also be fun. You know, like just something pure. Like the Kung Pao Enter the Fist would be a great movie to watch while stoned. You know?
But at the same time, there are the movies that are actually about stoners, like stoner characters, don't always hit with me because I'm not a stoner. I've only been high a couple times. So I too have watched the Cheech and Chong movies, and I feel like this isn't hitting me in the right way. I'm not high enough, or I haven't been high enough to understand exactly what Up in Smoke is trying to get at. Mm. Notice that there's stoner movies, but there's not like drunk movies to watch when you're just smashed.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, there are lots of movies, like The Long Weekend, but like you're talking about movies to watch while you are drunk. Well, I think drunk makes your mind, I mean, this isn't my experience, and I know it hits everyone differently. I think drunk makes your mind a little, like, dulled, whereas, you know, being high can do that, but sometimes it can also, depending on, like, what strain you're smoking, can make you just sort of go sort of free association into some fun places. So for me, when I, and I'm not that I'm telling all of you kids to do this, but when I have partaken in the devil's weed, I prefer to do so in such a way that I can either go right to sleep because it's a drug that does that, or I'm gonna watch something like weird and like try to come up with like odd ideas and sort of, you know, expand my consciousness, which is why Jodorowsky is great for it. But Jodorowsky would be a great double feature with Life of Brian. Actually, I think.
Oh, for sure. Like El Topo.
Yeah, I think El Topo.
Or Holy Mountain.
Yeah, Holy Mountain and Life of Brian would be a good double feature together. Shit. Yeah.
That's a good suggestion. All of that said, one of my favorite stoner movies is probably Greg Araki's Smiley Face.
Oh, that's so funny.
And I think I like that movie because we see her behavior, but the rest of the world looks at her very strangely. Mm. The main character is played by Anna Faris. Is not off the hook for anything. Like, she screws up and gets higher and higher and higher and keeps on screwing up even worse. And it becomes like this almost like sad sack story about this character who doesn't realize how badly she's fucking everything up.
Yeah.
And that's where the comedy comes from. You watch a Cheech and Chong movie, like, the rules don't really apply to them. Like, they kind of flout the good manners, and they just kind of float through life, and they don't realize the rules they've broken, and they don't really care. They're just sort of like agents of chaos. I see more in Cheech and Chong and something like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas than I do in something like Smiley Face. And because Smiley Face is, you know, about how hilarious this person is while she's high, but you're supposed to watch it while you're sober.
I think
that, and I think it's hilarious.
I think the thing about Smiley Face,
I think it's hilarious just all the way through.
I think Smiley Face might actually be a good double feature with the Jesus movie, because we associate our religious figures, like Jesus, or you pick your religious figure of choice, as people who have achieved a higher level of consciousness, right? People who are who are looking at the world in a more pure or moral or meaningful way, and that this makes them capable of seeing things that we are not, and we can say to ourselves, "Wow, you have really enlightened us." And Smiley Face is about someone who does who goes through that experience and achieves no enlightenment. Like, none.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like, no, no, like, what if you achieved this, like, completely out-of-body experience, and you got nothing out of it, and it just kind of ruined everyone's life for a day, in a funny way, but, like, still. The one downside, there, I will say this, there's one downside in Smiley Face, is that Danny Masterson plays a not insignificant role in it, and he's disgusting, and there's at least one or two shots that are... might remind you of some real stuff, and it's like that might bring you down. It's short. He's not in it a lot, but he is in it throughout the film, and that is something to consider. Might harsh your buzz.
I'm sorry. I didn't even think of that. I'm so sorry.
That's fine. I rewatched it like last year, and I was like, oh, I forgot he was in this. Oh, he's not in the whole thing, but it will. It did harsh my mellow.
Whatever you choose, though, the Jesus movie I would pair it with, because Smiley Face is a movie about a journey. She has to get from point A to point B, and she can't because she's too high. Christ was a traveler, traveled around, gave sermons, yep. And one of my favorite movies about Christ as sort of a preacher and a political figure, but it was told in a really realistic way, was Pier Paolo Pasolini's The Gospel According to St. Matthew.
Okay, I've never seen this.
From 1964. Okay. Then I encourage you to do so, because it is fan-freaking-tastic.
Okay.
Pasolini tried to tell the Christ story in like according to the rules of Italian neorealism. So it's like really grounded and realistic. Christ looks just like a guy. Like He's not like a beatific figure with like light pouring out of his head. He's just a guy, and you know, he has some interesting ideas. The way they handle the filmmakers handle the miracles in that film is really novel. And it's also worth noting that Pasolini was a stone cold atheist. He didn't believe in any of the divinity of it. And I think that his inspiration to make the movie came when he was like trapped in a hotel room and there was a Gideon Bible in there. It's like, well, I got nothing else to read, so he's just thumbing through the Bible. He's like, wait a minute. It's actually some fun philosophy in here. This would make a good film, like a thoughtful film. And so I feel like Pasolini, in being an atheist, is avoiding a lot of the trappings of the beatitudes of Christ and the divinity of Christ and focusing on the ideas of Christ. Mm. And I think that makes the film that much more interesting.
Totally different direction if you wanted to go for a different Christ movie I think it's Peter Medak who directed The Ruling Class with Peter O'Toole.
I never finished.
The Ruling Class. It is a very bleak comedy, but for a while it's really, really. It's really, really funny, and then it ends in a very dark way. Peter O'Toole plays the son of like a British lord, duke, something or other, and then that guy dies, and he has to inherit the estate. But everyone who is like stands to gain something from this transfer of money and power is very upset and very disturbed that Peter O'Toole thinks he's Jesus, and like he walks around dressed like Jesus, and he says lots of Jesus-y things. When he sleeps on a cross. Like, it's very, very, very absurd, and goes in some very dark places. But Peter O'Toole's amazing in it. So that might be an out of the box possibility, because it doesn't get talked about enough, I think. Anyway, let's do one more letter.
Okay, one more letter. Let's see here.
You can do it.
That one's too long. That one's too long. Sorry. Okay. These are great letters, and we'll get back to them, but here we go. This is from Josh. Hello, Josh.
Okay.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I just listened to your review of the new Captain America movie. Oh, remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It came out like a month ago. Yeah, there was,
that
there was
does
a
not feel
America
like
a
month ago.
About
Jesus
a month
Christ,
ago.
This year. Okay, yeah, moving on.
Yeah, like that, well, first like, of all, this year sucks. But secondly, that movie was like, it made $100 million its opening weekend, and it just, it is gone from the consciousness. Yeah. Like, it's...
Well, hold on. Let's it vanished. Let's like, see, it's not let's see where our listener is going with this. Maybe they have right. maybe some interesting points.
Anyway, I just listened to your new Captain America movie. While I appreciate your commentary on Disney erasing a trans character from a new Disney Plus show, you did fail to mention the almost complete erasure of Sabra from Brave New World.
Yeah.
Aside from a basically throwaway line about her being born in Israel, she is not shown in anything remotely resembling her comic book costume, basically an Israeli flag, and it seems that they cut out as many of her scenes as possible without having to reshoot half of the movie. Best regards, Josh. Which one was Sabra?
She was the, like, Harrison Ford's, like, chief of security. She was, you recognize her physically, she was a lot shorter than everyone else in the cast, but she was like,
Yeah,
no, they changed that character dramatically, because she's very, very much in the comics, like, she's wearing, you know, blue and white, and she's very much like the Israeli Captain America, basically, in the comics. Is there more to the letter?
I didn't realize that was, like, an existing superhero character.
Is there more to the letter, or is that it?
That's the end of the line.
Honestly.
I just looked up pictures. Yeah, she's got like a big Star of David on her costume and a big blue cape. Yeah, she's Captain Israel.
Basically. And listen, I don't know a ton about that character. I haven't really read a lot of comics with her in them. And frankly, the conversation around everything that went wrong or was odd or interesting about Captain America, Brave New World, there was plenty to talk about without even bringing her up. I would be very curious. Here's basically all I have to say about it. I would be very curious to know what the conversations were behind the scenes about A, including that character in the first place, especially as the chief of security for the American government, which is just odd choice. And then to include the character to the extent that people who know her recognize her, and then not go for it. Now, granted, there's a lot of characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe who, when we meet them, they're not the fully formed version of the character, and some of them do eventually get there, and some of them haven't yet or never will, I don't know. But this is a politically fraught time at that in that particular part of the world, and the rest of the world, and how we're responding to it. And so, including the character at all is a choice, a very specific creative choice that you had to know about, and then minimizing the defining quality of that character, despite the fact that you're including them, multiple conversations had to be had about whether to include her at all, how to include her, and I would be fascinated to be privy to those. I'd love to be a fly on the wall, because I honestly don't even know where their head was at, what their concerns were, what their concerns weren't. It seems very strange.
When it comes to film production, they usually put a lot of work and energy into these films, like, years in advance. Sometimes films take, you know, 10, 15, 20 years to finally make it to the screen. And a lot of the creative decisions that are made early on are kind of, just stubbornly stick in through, like, one draft to the next. Yeah. They don't think, hey, why don't we get rid of that character? So I'm guessing the inclusion of Sabra was probably several years ago, before there was a lot of violence and everything that's going on in Gaza right now.
Well, I mean, there was violence before, but like before it became what it is now. Yeah.
Every film is made, you know, the time that it's made, and sometimes it's rather unfortunately released into not a political vacuum. No film is, and. So, yeah, it would be interesting to know, like, at what point they decided to include the character and why, and then what they had to do as current events continued to change. When they essentially have Captain Israel, but then they have to, like, not say that they have Captain Israel in the movie.
Yeah. No. As I said, interesting choices were made. I don't know enough about the character or the behind the scenes to come to any sort of meaningful conclusion about that, but it is sure as hell worth noting. Yeah.
But that makes me even angrier at the movie, though. Because we don't like this movie, by the
way.
Oh,
no.
We both give it
I think it's terrible.
Yeah, we give it a very negative review.
I think it's one of the worst Marvel movies.
And one of the things that really pisses me off about this movie in particular, but about the Marvel series in general, is, and especially about Captain America, is how apolitical they strive to be.
Yeah.
They're trying to not have a political point of view when you have a character who's literally dressed in a fucking American flag.
Right.
It's like, take a stand, you guys. Say something. Mm. And, you know, Brave New World is aggressively trying not to say anything. And you're telling me that they decided to include the character of Captain Israel and, colloquially, I'm just using it, in this movie, and they're still not making any political points about it. They're not bringing
like
it
you didn't
up.
Have to include
that's
that
just
character.
Another
I'm not
thing
saying
they're ignoring.
I'm not saying it's a good idea or a bad idea. I honestly don't know how the hell you handle it. But you chose to include the character. What were you getting at? What was the plan here? And how did that character go from being very distinctly of a certain region and culture, and then become the chief of security for the United States? Are you suggesting, like, a sort of connection between the U.S. and the Israeli government? Because you could make that commentary. There might be something to explore in that. I don't think they are. They aggressively don't go there. So I honestly don't know. But this is one of those movies, and I know this movie went through a lot of post-production woes. It got delayed and delayed, and I'm sure there were reshoots. It feels like there were reshoots. I honestly don't know if there was ever like a cohesive version of this film. You know, like, you know, the other Captain America movies have flaws to varying degrees, but, you know, the first Avenger feels like a cohesive film. The Winter Soldier feels like a cohesive film. Civil War mostly feels like a cohesive film. This feels like a patchwork thing that just happened, and none of the creative decisions they're really connect well with the other creative decisions, nor do they add up to much at the end. It's annoying.
So great. You brought up something else that I hate about this movie. I like it even less.
Right.
So
that's
impressive, and not because of. You know, the way they handled the character, the fact that they didn't handle the character. That's what really pisses me off now.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for bringing that up. I'm surprised we didn't bring it up in our review, but as I said, we had a lot of ground to cover. That is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for joining us. We think you're fabulous. Sorry if we didn't get to your email this time. We will have more episodes. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net if you want to write in with your questions, concerns, pushback, tell us we're wrong. You know, we're open to it, so just send them on down. Once again, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is the P.O. box that occasionally you do check?
I do check it. Send us a letter or a postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. And, of course, we're on social media on Blue Sky, at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And a huge shout-out to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. You keep this show going, and it would be impossible to do it without you. And honestly, just not even just for us, it's a very, very difficult time in publishing and the world of just creators trying to make a living doing what they do, and supporting people through their newsletters or their Patreon or however that is really means a lot to us. And in some cases, it's the difference between paying our rent and not paying our rent. And I realize not everyone can afford to do so, but if there are creators who you support and you feel like could use the assistance, I encourage you to consider it. Even if it's $1 a month, it adds up. That's not just us. There's a lot of people are going through some really difficult times right now, and every little bit helps. So thank you to everyone who has the means and chooses to support us and everyone else whose work they care about. It means the world. Thank you. That's it. So, thank you again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
Everyone's talking about AI these days, right? This season on Compiler, we're diving deep into how AI is reshaping the world we live in. Join us for a new season of Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Cleveland Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.